sound.
How about that?
Your job.
Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and we ask you to hold your calls for the time being, although we'll welcome them later in the program at 1-888-24-LIBERTY out across America and here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But for the time being, hold your calls. We have with us Bill Sardi, who's a health journalist, a researcher, and certainly a very good friend of Radio Liberty. Bill, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Great. Wonderful to be with you. I've never had such an interesting time to share with you Of course, because we have dramatic events that are ready to happen, and of course the Homeland Defense, all of that legislation is due to go into action, I believe, officially this weekend or somewhere thereabouts, and that gives the president and shifts a whole base of power and a whole bunch of government agencies under one umbrella. And of course, I believe that the Bush administration has been waiting for that to occur so that then various things can take place. So, of course, we're tremendously concerned about this. I don't believe the country will ever be the same after this weekend. Mm. I just have that sense.
Well, I think that, of course, the president is intent upon going to war. It really doesn't matter that, you know, that this war could have tremendous implications as far as America is concerned. A lot of Americans already seem to be convinced that, oh, well, it's just going to be a tea time war, an easy war. It'll be over just like the first Gulf War, and I hope and pray they're right. But, of course, there is the alternative, and that is that this could have a profound impact upon our economy, our relationship with the countries of Europe, our relationship with the Muslim world. And, of course, it is possible, although I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it's possible that there would be a biological attack on America. Because if Saddam Hussein is pushed to the wall, he has no place to go and he knows he's going to be destroyed. He is just enough of a psychopath to strike back. And I would think he would strike at Israel as well, but he would try to create some sort of an incident here in America. And we know that he intended to actually create problems here in the United States back in 1990 and 1991 from a book written by Joseph Badansky, who was director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Nonconventional Warfare. And in his book, Attack America and the West, which was published in 1993 and actively suppressed, you can't get a copy of that, or at least I've had great difficulty getting any copies of that book here in America. So somebody suppressed that book. Why? Because I think, at least in part, because it told about the fact that there were plans to create disruption here in America, and the only reason they didn't occur is because Syria and Iran would not go along with it. Well, what's going to happen now? Only time's going to tell. But I have that same sense of foreboding you do, Bill. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about what you think may happen, as the president now has said he's just going to go ahead. Doesn't matter what the UN says. Doesn't matter what the world thinks. Now, he knows what's right.
Well, certainly tonight, for tomorrow morning's newspapers, the London Guardian reporting that Bush has said it's war within weeks is their quote and their headline. It says that President Bush will give the State of the Union message on Tuesday and that, of course, he expects to go to war. I've said that the date, it seems to be in the news media given to us by the Israeli press and others, seems to be in the month of March, very early then. I believe that that's when they are targeting this whole thing. Tonight in the BBC News, British Broadcasting, a group of 500 doctors from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine delivered a letter to both President Bush and Tony Blair suggesting that they find peaceful methods of intervening with Iraq without going to war. Because, as they suggest, a World Health Organization report suggests that there'll be 100,000 to 400,000 indirect casualties to this war. There'll be financial consequences. They expect that many millions of people will suffer malnutrition, and they expect this conflict at least to last 3 months, and that that there will be lots of deaths involved. So, the medical profession on the other side of the ocean. Launching an objection. We've seen them here, and none is as astounding as the one by Time Magazine last night in an online poll, a surprising one that was forwarded to me. And I wonder why Time is doing this now, because usually they side with the president, and they ask the online users, which country poses the greatest danger to the world in peace in the year 2003, North Korea, Iraq, or the United States. Here were the votes cast by 273,000 people. They said it's an unscientific, informal survey on the Internet, but the which country poses the greatest danger to world peace? North Korea, 7.8%, Iraq, 8.8%, the United States, 83.4%. something is changing. The mood of the country is different than the president. Obviously, he's not sold us. We read where 8 out of 10 people in France oppose the war. Maybe we would expect that, but that's about the same number of people that are opposing the war in a recent Seattle Times poll. So we're not seeing the kind of support for the war that usually presidents of the past have usually roused up with propaganda or through other legitimate methods. And so we do see and we do predict there'll be great division. And one of the things I am concerned about is there has been a message sent out to the police chiefs in the United States to try and find out all the people who have registered guns. And this is under the guise that if there was some sort of a rebellion against the smallpox vaccination, that they would take people who had guns and deputize them to help, of course, quell any kind of civil disturbance. Of course, why would you target people with guns? You could deputize anybody. You see, the point is they may want to know where the guns are so that they can stop any opposition whatsoever. Of course, this has me really frightened. And now that I see that a desperate president losing his support in the polls, and of course presidents have been known to pull all kinds of crazy stunts in order to rally the American people behind them. And I don't know how desperate this man may be in regards to our government. I'm certainly not anything less than a patriot of the United States. I'm certainly not given to arouse people to have false suspicions or whatever. I was never behind all the craziness of Y2K and all that kind of thing. I can tell you that this is a different feeling for me because I sense that the whole world is involved and I sense that there's real facts and issues behind this. And of course, it's a concern. We've never resolved where the anthrax came from. It came from our own army labs. It seems like the federal government, the White House, knew about this beforehand. That's why they were why they were given the Cipro beforehand. So we're concerned that maybe the United States government would find it convenient to either relax security measures and let something happen. We have no idea, in order to drive the American public behind an effort to go to war. So, and we're concerned that there's another impetus behind this, and that is our collapsing economy. We have $20 trillion of obligations to the American people, which the U.S. Treasury Department now admits it has no anticipated income against. $20 trillion. Understand, we only do $10 trillion of business as a country, as the United States of America, in a year. This is a tremendous admission. We go back to June earlier in 2002, where Paul O'Neill, then the Secretary of the Treasury, said that he was 1 week away from bouncing all the pension checks in the United States. Folks, the Social Security Bank is empty. The money is there on the books. They took it out and borrowed it for other reasons. They're just printing money to get us there. And when a country is hiding a desperate financial situation, as you see all of our states now going into financial turmoil, and of course they're going to have to pull something off in order to keep this boat going. One of the concerns we have is we're just going to war to maybe break the oil cartel. Understand, if they can bring down the price of oil, you'll throw hundreds of millions of dollars back into the economy instead of going to oil. And, of course, for power, it would go to rebuild the country. So you see maybe some sort of an honest effort here to rebuild, but we have to go to war to do it. It seems like a terrible consequence. And I don't know how many billions it'll cost us. Even worse, I believe that there'll be some sort of retribution. There'll be some sort of fighting back by the Muslim world, Islamic world, and I think we'll pay for a long time to come.
Well, you know, you make the point that there was poor knowledge of the anthrax attack. And I don't know whether our listeners know this, but if anybody would like the verification of that, there's actually something we got from Larry Klayman recently and other articles verifying the fact that on the evening of September 11th of the year 2001, when, of course, the smoke and the fires were still there at the World Trade Center and everybody was in a state of shock, why the president and Vice President and the White House staff were placed on Cipro on the very day of the terrorist attack. Now, obviously, somebody either suspected or knew an anthrax attack was coming. The first letter was postmarked. The first anthrax letter was postmarked the 11th of September, and they were sent out over the following several days. And, of course, because of the problems with the mail, why they were somewhat slow in getting there, the planes weren't flying. And, of course, I think the first people started getting sick a couple of weeks later. There were actually 18 people who got ill. Five of them died. But how did the White House, how did the Vice President and the President know that there was going to be an anthrax attack? If they were suspicious, why didn't they warn the American people? Why didn't they, as soon as their first letter arrived through the mail, why didn't they place everybody in the Postal Department on Cipro? Why did they protect themselves and leave the American people unprotected? And, of course, these are the haunting questions that we have, especially when we know that this was militarized anthrax of the type we have in our military laboratories. Whoever handled that anthrax had to have been vaccinated. To be completely vaccinated, it takes 18 months and 6 shots. So the anthrax attack was planned long ahead of time, and I don't think it was planned by Osama bin Laden. I don't think that he or any of his people are working in our military laboratories, at least I hope not. And if they were, then how did our government, how did somebody in the White House know that they should start people on Cipro? Because Cipro is not simply an innocuous antibiotic. It has multiple possible complications, including rupture of tendons, rupture of the Achilles tendon. I'm sure you know all those complications of Cipro better than I do, Bill. Maybe you can list them. But the fact that they gave the people a potentially dangerous antibiotic meant that they were seriously concerned about an anthrax attack in the White House when nobody else in America was even thinking of it.
Well, and if you were a terrorist today, wouldn't you have already taken your smallpox and struck with it before we had any vaccine? Why does the United States make preparation as if it knows there's going to be a smallpox attack when there are many types of biological weapons? And why wouldn't the smallpox terrorists use strains of these viruses and so on we couldn't protect from? I mean, this makes no sense. It's like the United States is working with assurance that vaccination will actually work and that we have the protection with the right strain of the vaccine and everything.
Well, of course, the frightening implications of this are, if you study the history of smallpox, and you know that in centuries past, it's devastated entire populations. It certainly was instrumental in wiping out the Indians in both North and South America. And, of course, you know, this is a bad disease. But, you know, starting back about in the early 1970s, they announced we didn't have any more smallpox in the world. And therefore, you could not get a vaccination if you wanted to, because the government was there to help, and they weren't going to give it to you, because I think 2 people in a million die, and another 20 or 30 people in a million will have some serious encephalitis or other complications. And then, of course, other people can, on rare occasions, get a vaccine infection if you are vaccinated. In other words, we introduced the cowpox. But why did they stop all vaccination, number one? Why are they putting on a massive propaganda campaign to convince us there's going to be a smallpox epidemic, of course started by the wicked Saddam Hussein? Why are they totally ignoring the advice of the medical board that they put together and convened back at the CDC in Atlanta, Georgia, that said, look, it's ridiculous to start vaccinating if we don't even know there's going to be an attack. And if we had cases of smallpox, we should do ring vaccination. In other words, vaccinate everybody in the area, but don't vaccinate the entire population. It's totally illogical. And, of course, after convening this board of experts, what did the administration decide to do? Why, to vaccinate our entire military, several million, to vaccinate 10 million healthcare workers, as if they knew there was going to be a smallpox epidemic. And I really rather believe there is going to be a smallpox epidemic. Could you imagine what will happen throughout the rest of the world? We will be vaccinated and the rest of the world will die.
And understand, in the New York Times here, just 2 days ago, it said United States is deploying a monitoring system for germ attacks. And it has these monitoring stations around the country. It's taking little tissue paper-like samples and then sending them into laboratories. So what's all this about? Where's this coming from? Like there's some upgraded threat, and all of a sudden you can understand we may have a headline that there are the certain kind of samples coming in from different cities and so on. Of course, understand these tests could all be false and panic the population unnecessarily. The Seattle Times running an article here just yesterday say one person's smallpox vaccine may be risky for others. It says if everybody in Washington State gets vaccinated, there'll be 800,000 people that risk a severe reaction from a close contact with a person who got vaccinated. I mean, and these are the people that are immune compromised. They just added up the number of people with eczema and have various kinds of immune problems and so on. 800,000 people at risk. It's not worth that risk. We should only vaccinate when we have to. We're going to harm more people than it's going to benefit.
Unless, of course, there is going to be a worldwide epidemic. And, you know, Bill, if you think of it logically, if you were Saddam Hussein, you might be a nut, a psychopath, but you would not unleash a smallpox epidemic in the United States because it would spread throughout the world with the ease of travel, airplane travel, and soon it would be in the people of Iraq and the Iraq army, which don't have any vaccine, and it would sweep the Muslim world, and literally hundreds of millions of Muslims would die. So why would Saddam Hussein unleash a smallpox attack? Why would the communists in Russia unleash a smallpox attack? Their people aren't vaccinated. In fact, the only two people that are getting vaccinated are certain people in the British Isles, in the United States, and in Israel. And you have to ask yourself, is there possibly another agenda? And, you know, there's so many questions we have. And unless perhaps you read some of the things that people have written, like Bertrand Russell writing in his book, The Impact of Science on Society. And we have this, if anybody wants to see the pages from his book, where he talks about how wonderful it would be if we had a black plague that would sweep the world every generation and maintain the world population. And then people could procreate as much as they wanted to, and it really wouldn't matter if we just had a black plague that would sweep the world. Or certainly our friend Jacques Cousteau, writing in the UNESCO Courier in November of 1991, saying, oh, it's a terrible thing to have to say, but we really have to eliminate 350,000 people a day to bring the world back in balance. Or Barbara Marx Hubbard, in her book, Revelation, the book of co-creation, talking about the necessity of killing a quarter of the world's population, and then writing, of course, that's not your job, my dear. That is ours, for we are the riders of the pale horse death. Remember, Barbara Marx Hubbard ran for vice president in 1984 against Geraldine Ferraro on the Democrat ticket. Barbara Marx Hubbard has been a consultant to our Defense Department. Barbara Marx Hubbard is on the board of the World Future Society, along with a man named Maurice Strong and Robert McNamara. You remember Robert McNamara. He was the man who sent our boys to fight and bleed and suffer and die in Vietnam, but never be allowed to win. Robert McNamara, deeply involved in the occult, and of course, a man who was responsible more than any other single human being for the 58,000 American boys who either perished or are left in captivity in Vietnam. So, I mean, there are people that have a different worldview, and the people who really believe there are too many people in the world, and wouldn't it be wonderful if we did have a massive plague that would eliminate large numbers of them? And yet it's so hard for people to believe that.
It is hard to believe. Understand that in China there are 1.5 billion people. In 1958 and 59, 30 to 40 million of those people died of starvation. They had agrarian reform. They had small farms started at that time. Today, out of a population of 1.5 million, 900 million.
A billion, excuse me.
There's 900 million Chinese farmers out of that population. Now, they're going to modernize the farms, make them large instead of small. They're going to bring the bigger farm equipment and harvesting equipment. And when they're going to do that, they're going to put millions out of business. I mean, you're talking about 500 million farmers out of work. And the question in China now, because I was there 3 years ago, I'm still in communication with people that go to China regularly, and the question on the Chinese mind is, what are we going to do with these people? And if I just let the radio audience pause for a minute and ask them, what would you do? What would you be thinking about doing?
Well,
if I said eliminate them, Would that come to your mind? Do we understand what the world may face in doing some sinister type of work to eliminate people?
Well, you know, if anybody has read the Global Biodiversity Assessment that came out of the Second Earth Summit in 1992, and we actually have that summarized in my Sustainable Development syllabus, and basically at one point they're talking about how many people are on the world, and they're saying about 6 billion people, and we just can't maintain that many people at our current living standards. If we want to maintain the current living standards, we've got to get the population down to about 2 billion people, otherwise everybody's going to live at the level of the Eastern European. And they don't say peasant, but that's what they're really talking about. And they talk in these terms, how shortages of food are better than abundance of food. Too many people in the world. A Global Biodiversity Assessment, you can get it at your library, published by Cambridge University Press, and if you want the exact page reference, we can get that for you. You need to check out these facts, check out what we've said. If you want it verified, a lot of this is up on my website at radioliberty.com, the Population Control Agenda monograph. Pull it down, duplicate it, and then check the facts and find out if it's true. Because if it is true, why the life that is at stake may well be that of a loved one. There are people who have a different worldview than the average individual. And I agree with you, Bill. I have that uneasy feeling that we are on the edge, just on the very precipice of dramatic changes.
Here in this country, we have 40 million people with a $20 trillion commitment that we can't live up to. We have 40 million older adults. When you look at a pie chart of where the money is spent in the United States, you know, the three big pieces of the pie, the three quarters of the pie is military spending, pensions, Social Security, and, of course, Medicare. Two of the three are for older people. Now, you just start asking yourself, just, you know, knowing medicine and how I do, and you say to yourself, the older people are prone to a viral infection, something that would wipe them out. When we have, you know, waterborne infections in a community or some sort of food poisoning, it always strikes the very young and the very old. What if we just invented some way of getting rid of our retirees? Just 10% of them. There would go 4 million, and we would fix our budget crisis. I'm sorry to think so sinisterly, but I have to think ahead and ask myself, what is going on? Why are we seeing these kinds of changes? I don't know that any of that is on anyone's mind. God help us that it's on anyone's mind. But you have to ask yourself, how are they going to get out of this? How are they going to get out of this mess? And, of course, with fiscal problems like we've never seen before, you eliminate the people that, of course, where you're spending the greatest amount of money.
Well, of course, you know, Thomas Malthus, who we hear of Malthusianism, but Thomas Malthus was an Anglican minister. Who, of course, worshipped a different god than you and I do. And writing, at the end of the 18th and early part of the 19th century, he said, you know, what we want to do is encourage the communities to build their cities next to stagnant water, to discourage cleanliness, and definitely to discourage anybody who wants to stop major plagues. Now, Thomas Malthus thought there were too many people in the world. And, of course, his concepts of Malthusianism, that, of course, the population grows exponentially, whereas the amount of food just doubles as you go along, that soon we would have far too many people in the world. And, of course, his ideas became the basis of first eugenics and what is today known as population control. But, of course, population control's real goal is killing off large parts of the population. That's why they encourage homosexuality, because they don't reproduce. That's why they encourage abortion and euthanasia. That's why they, of course, encourage the dissemination of disease. But, of course, they can't tell the people that because, well, you know, that's just sort of not a nice thing to do. So they couch it in other terms. Not only rarely do they, as with Bertrand Russell in his a book, The Impact of Science on Society, or Barbara Marx Hubbard in her book, The Revelation, the Book of Co-Creation, and we're talking about the original manuscript, really let the cat out of the bag. We're going to kill a significant part of the world population. And yet, these are the leaders who are lauded and applauded by so many people. Jacques Cousteau, we'll have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. I wonder how many of our listeners have ever gone to get a copy of the UNESCO Courier in November of 1991 to find out if we're telling the truth. If you doubt it, just give us a call, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll send you the pages from the UNESCO Courier in either English or in French. But it's all there. It's real. There really are people. Yes, Virginia, there really are people who would like to kill the large part of the world's population.
I don't think there's any question in my mind when we look at the abortion issue. What we did is we aborted and killed 40 million American babies.
It's actually up to, latest figures, 42 million.
I see, 42 million.
But of course, we financed the killing probably of half a billion throughout the world, another 500 million aborted with our financing. So
what has that got to do with what we're talking about? What it has to do with is that we've got too many old people and not enough young people to pay for the old people. That's what they're saying our problem is. But we killed 40 million of them. You see, we made our own financial crisis out of this. We needed as many young people as we could possibly get. Now, of course, we're in a big mess financially.
And, of course, you see this in so many other countries. I mean, in Japan, where they do not allow immigration here, I mean, they have opened the gates to get as many people in, you know, to come into the country to pay into our Social Security. In Japan, they don't allow immigrants, and they have the graying of Japan, and there are very, very few children. And they don't know what they're going to do with all the old people because, of course, they promised them pensions and there's no money to pay it.
Well, they are living longer than any other society in Japan. This is new. This is not anything by tradition. And, of course, they're coming to grips with this faster. They handle the health care problems a little bit differently. They don't have the same health care bills because they are healthier. On the other hand, they're living longer and there are greater social costs. They don't tend to put people in nursing homes. They don't like that that stigma, so they put them in what they call a hospital, but all they really do is change the bedpans and the bed sheets. They don't do over-treatment, which in a way has some good things about it. So they handle it a little differently there, but then again, it's due to crack, as it is in Canada, as the healthcare system is cracking in Britain. They've now told all the British that work till you're 75, save your money because you will live in poverty otherwise. They're going to tell us the same thing here. So I don't think there's any question. It's not population, it's money, and they have to control the population in some way. I believe there was a recent study, and I'm flipping through my papers as I talk to you, and it was a recent big study showing that this population thing is really all a myth, that the rates of birth rates and so on go down as populations as their economies improve and so on. So if we would westernize and modernize these countries, we wouldn't see such tremendous increases. And, of course, it's just some of this is overdone. By the way,
we're going to have to interrupt you there, Bill. We're going to have to take a break. And when we get back, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there across America listening to us, we hope that many of you will decide right now that you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, of course, we hope that many of you will agree that there are serious problems in our society and that you recognize that this is a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And so if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, of course, we'd love to have your help and support. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, and our December newsletter deals with the occult foundation of our nation's monetary supply. And people say, occult foundation of the monetary supply? What are you talking about? Well, I suggest you get the newsletter and read it. Of course, we hope that many of you will want to take it on a regular basis. But if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, the telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or I remember it as 5-HIV-WAR. And we'll be glad to send you a free copy if you haven't had one before. And then we ask you to go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And, of course, you can pull down our letters. They're all up there. shortly after we finish them, and you can pull down our population control agenda monographer. You can pull down so much else that we have written, and you are feel free to copy that. You can actually see the pictures of the Georgia Guidestones in Elberton, Georgia. Where inscribed in 8 different languages on these 4 great granite stones is the plan that comes from the dark side. And point number one is maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. I've been to the Georgia Guidestones many times. I've been to the files there in the library. And one of these days, if we ever have a chance, I'll write the full story of what this is really all about. But it goes right back to the Malthusian concept, too many people in the world. And of course, not enough natural, not enough elements, not enough food, not enough materials and minerals. So we're just going to have to dramatically decrease the world population. If you stop and think about it, maintaining the world population at 500 million means we're going to have to kill off over 90% of the world population. You say that couldn't be true. Well, I suggest you go to my website, see the Georgia Guidestone pictures, and then go back there and do as I do. Go to the library, and you'll find out that the UFOs have been seen hovering over the monument. Now, what does UFOs have to do with it? Because this whole thing is demonic. It is all demonic. And when you understand it's demonic and an effort to kill God's highest creation, which is mankind, then it all begins to make sense. So then, of course, we hope that you'll tell others about our website. You can certainly listen to our programs there directly 3 hours a day. Indirectly, there are links to the American Freedom Network and the Genesis Network, that 2 more hours a day. So you can listen 5 hours every day and not get much accomplished. But no, listen when you can, but try to get others to listen. And believe me, people telling people telling people is how our listening audience is growing all across America. So again, remember the website, it's radioliberty.com. Remember our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And we'll be right back here with our very, very special guest this evening, Bill Sardi. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Bill Sardi, who's a health journalist, a health researcher. Bill, let's get your website out there in case people would like to get in touch with you and get your fascinating information.
Oh, I know the military has been calling me personally and emailing me and asking me. They're afraid they're going to be put on an airplane, sent to the Middle East, and then, of course, they're being told they're going to have the vaccination needle forced on them while they're in the airplane. So they're frightened of this. They don't know what this vaccine is, and none of us do. It's a new vaccine. It's a critically different vaccine where it's untried, basically, and there will be problems, I anticipate. And, of course, giving the two legs of our society, our healthcare workers and our military people, an untried vaccine, I think, is absolutely foolish. We could go into chaos with this. And then, of course, the healthcare workers could give it to all their patients, the elderly, and that's who they're taking care of, are people with immune problems. You want to find answers to this, go to my website, askbillsardi.com. That's B-I-L-L-S-A-R-D-I. I've got answers for you there on autism and all about things like the smallpox vaccine and so on. Lots of health and nutrition ideas, natural antibiotics and so on. Things that you need to know, and it's all free and without any commercial interest.
And of course, the important thing is that you want to get your immune system up to its maximum. I might just mention we have some excellent interviews with Dr. Russell Blaylock. We have that in something called Health Secrets or Life-Saving Secrets, I think is what we call the tape set, Life-Saving Secrets. It's Dr. Blaylock's information. There's a 4-tape set on that. I think you'll find it fascinating. And it really overlaps so much with what Bill Sardi has talked about building up your immunity using selenium and zinc and the vitamin C and vitamin E and some of the other natural products out there, which do give you a tremendous boost to your immune system. And, of course, if we've really faced all these 56 biological agents that are out there that could be used for biological warfare, the only solution would be to build up your immunity. So these are exciting times, difficult times, frightening times to live in. wonderful times to know the Lord, because without that behind you, why, of course, men's hearts would simply fail them for fear. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 if you're out there listening and have a question or comment. I'm just going to make one statement, then let Bill carry on. But one of the most cleverly coordinated propaganda barrages I've ever seen. And if you look back, is the effort to convince us there's going to be a smallpox attack. Now, you look back over the last year, and day after day, week after week, month after month, one or another article on the danger of smallpox. The average American has never heard of the 35 to 40 million Chinese who died of starvation as a result of the farming changes that took place in China, the efforts to actually communize the farming there, and to take the property away from the farmers and have collective farms. You could totally suppress that in the United States. You could suppress, for instance, the video like Stephen Emerson put out on jihad in America in 1994, telling about the Islamic terrorists. They were here, they were plotting jihad in 1994. You could keep that video from being shown on television. There are other videos that we've talked about going into the pedophile rings that operate at the highest levels of our country. Films made in other countries and totally suppressed here. Films on the KGB in America, and they're totally suppressed here in the United States. But obviously, they're doing everything they can to focus our attention on that danger of smallpox. Oh, just watch the papers. You'll see these articles here turn up day after day after day. Why are they doing it? Because they want us to believe there's going to be a smallpox epidemic, and they may very well be a major smallpox epidemic. But you can see how they're able to coordinate the media, whether it be television or radio or newspapers or magazines, and then they focus the attention of the American people on one specific issue, and by so doing, control the reality. So you pick it up from there, Bill, and if you're out in the listening audience and you'd like to give us a call, you know our number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295.
Well, certainly an article, this was actually an older article that I found, but it was published in 1996. Comes from the Rockefeller Foundation. It simply said that the World Health Organization determined, along with other population experts, the United Nations, that we would have 694 billion people on the Earth by the year 2150 if we let things continue to grow as they were. However, the biggest population expert probably on the planet, Joel Cohen, he's from New York, a professor of population at the Rockefeller University, and he says it simply isn't going to happen. The birth rates just calm down normally. It just does not happen that way. And, of course, the estimates of the number of people the Earth can handle vary from 1 billion to 1 trillion. No one really knows. I have books here on my shelves. How many people can the Earth sustain? Just so everyone knows, you can take all 6 billion people on the planet and put them inside the limits of Jacksonville, Florida. So you haven't got too many people. In fact, I have a report here, December 4th of last year, that's just a month ago or so, it says global analysis finds nearly half of the Earth is still wilderness. Have you flown in an airplane? Have you flown over Nebraska? Have you flown over Iowa? Have you flown over Nevada? What do you see? You don't see people. You see open land. Now they're going to talk about water and all those things. Those things are somewhat true. But remember, we're not even producing enough food, as much food as the United States can produce. We're under limits. We don't really produce all of the food that we could. Same for Canada and so on. A lot of the things, a lot of the real truth, it's amazing how we bought into this idea that, well, I guess we'll just need abortion. I guess we'll just need to kill people. It's true, we will probably add 1 billion people to the Earth every 11 years. I'm not sure that we don't have the resources to handle all this. I don't see any foreseeable reason why the Earth can't sustain more people. But if you're Jacques Cousteau, as you mentioned before, you see Earth is Gaia. Gaia is God, and God is the Earth. And people are inconsequential. We're not valuable. Earth is. And we have to keep, of course, this spaceship Earth is valued against human life. Well, certainly we want to maintain the planet. I don't think this excuses irresponsibility in any way. But what I'm saying is that a lot of the information we hear is propaganda. People have agendas. And, of course, one way or one reason for this is the financial mess that countries are in today, and maybe they have to control populations. But now what they have to do, as you can understand, is they have to do it by age groups, because it's the older age groups that are living longer, and they don't want them to.
Well, let's go to Roy, who's calling us from Louisiana. Hi, Roy. How are you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Stan.
Hey, it's good to hear from you.
Good to speak with you. Mr. Sardi, I appreciate the information you've given us, and I've started taking many of the supplements you suggested, including the Allicin.
That's good. Yeah, there is this new garlic pill called Allicin, the Alimax capsules. You can also get this out of fresh garlic, and I certainly hope everybody catches on to this, by the way. The active ingredient in fresh crushed garlic will kill, in a laboratory dish, I didn't say it was going to cure everybody's disease, but it will kill in a laboratory dish anthrax and smallpox and all those things. I think that's great encouragement for us to know. So go ahead, you must have a question.
Yes, sir. Dr. Stan knows I'm a doctor, and I've had a lot of our nurses turn to me and ask me what I'm going to do about the smallpox vaccine. I've told them, and I'll tell your audience, and I'll tell anybody else, I will not voluntarily be vaccinated. Is there a single source or a group of sources that I can point these people to give them a good overall view on the dangers of the vaccine?
You know, the dangers of the vaccine, all you need to do, I know a lot of people may not go online, but if you just go to cdc.gov, cdc.gov, and just type in the word, that's the Centers for Disease Control, and type in smallpox, and you will see a horrendous number of pictures and horrible things that come from the vaccine itself. And, of course, they're going to try and scare you about the disease as well. Well, it is a vicious disease. I think we've all seen those pictures of the scabs and things on people's skin. However, I must say that this is not the first smallpox threat this nation has faced. It had greater threats in the past, if you think about it. Immigrants coming in and all kinds of things. We had this disease here in this country, and we were never as panicked as we are now. What's this whole scenario about? What is all this scare technique about? We did not vaccinate the whole country when we had the disease here.
But to make it more ludicrous, the statistics that keep getting thrown in our face are statistics almost when there were no antibiotics, certainly when there were no ancillary services and the extended care things that we have available to us today.
That's correct. And I don't believe even if people got this horrendous disease, they tell us it's terrible. Well, I agree, life may be not worth living once you get it. But I'll have to tell you this. We have much better health care today, much better nutrition and so on. I don't believe you're going to end up with any serious cases like you saw in the pictures that they spread around. So I believe we have better ways of treating things today. And I believe it's not going to have the same. It's a virus. We know how to handle the immune system today. We know how to boost it up and to care for it much better. We don't have perfect care, but certainly I have to believe we have better ways of dealing with these things today. You certainly see it as a physician, so I know that you're not going to see the same kind of outbreaks as you saw in the past. And many of us may have it in our neighborhood and never come down with it. And many people, by the way, came in contact with people who had smallpox and never came down with it themselves. It's a little difficult to get because it's just like the flu or anything else. You do have to come in direct face-to-face contact, and you have to be pretty close for a significant amount of time to really get this. So it's not like you can walk around an airport and give it to everybody.
There's an excellent summary on smallpox on the Vaccine Center's website, and I think it's 919-SHOT. I really should have that available. But the Vaccine Center, you might type that in on your... But it's Barbara Lowe Fisher's material. She wrote a great analysis of smallpox. And I think everything is going to hinge on if there really is a smallpox epidemic. If there's a smallpox epidemic, then we may reevaluate our position. But right now, they're telling everybody to get vaccinated, and we don't know whether there's going to be an epidemic or not. If it is, and let me just play the devil's advocate. if they really do release the smallpox. And I'm not saying, I do not believe for 1 minute Saddam Hussein is going to release the smallpox. If they were to release the smallpox, could we depend upon the vaccine? That would be the big question I would have. If we could depend on the vaccine, we knew that they hadn't put something in it, as they obviously did with the boys we sent to the Gulf, because 200,000 of them have come home ill, and the government lost the shot records. Would they put something into the vaccine experimentally or specifically to harm our boys? Almost a third of the young men who went off to fight for freedom in 1990 are sick today. So, we're in difficult times. I think that we're going to have to wait and see how this thing unfolds. But right now, with no evidence of smallpox anywhere in the world, I think it'd be absurd to take it. If they actually start having smallpox across the country, well, we'll talk about it then. But right now, I think it's so important everybody gets their immune system up just as much as we can.
Well, it's not just an issue of what they might put in the vaccine. If they release smallpox, it's going to be weaponized. The vaccine is highly unlikely to do a stinking bit of good.
You may be absolutely right. All of these, there's so many unanswered questions.
Well, would you vaccinate your entire military, which means you're going to give it to the, all at once and face the risk of side effects? But even worse, you see, they're going to give it to all the ancillary people they come in contact with. If they come back from there, in any given quick time. Let me put it this way. If you give the vaccine here, you may spread it to the family members here.
You're talking about the vaccinia infection, right?
Vaccinia.
Right.
So you're going to not give smallpox, but you'd give cowpox, this vaccinia. You'd give it, to the family members here if you vaccinate them on shore before they leave. So it could be spreading here, you see, as a secondary infection or we're giving a little bit of a bug called vaccinia to protect you from smallpox. That's what we're doing. So, to give a little bit of a disease to so many people, who are the people you're depending on to defend your country, either the healthcare workers or the military, I don't know, I want that responsibility all at one time. I certainly might do this in small groups over time, but I certainly wouldn't do it this way.
And we're in difficult times, Roy. Hey, we've got to run. We've got a board full of people calling.
Thank you very much.
God bless you. Keep listening. Thanks so much.
Yes, sir. Good night.
Bye-bye. And let's go to John from Post Falls. Is that Idaho?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah, question or comment?
Well, I'll make it real quick. I certainly want to repudiate the Gaia Malthusian crowds. I recall the late physicist Jerry K. O'Neill wrote in the early 80s that it takes about a kilowatt of energy to produce $1 gross national product. So if we could get some kind of a hydrogen economy going, I don't think the Earth would have any problem sustaining 10, 20, or 100 billion people.
Boy, this caller hit it right on. By the way, if you want to bring the economy back, they're looking for something that would bring the stock market back. You see, it has to be a segment. Now, the Wall Street did this with the Internet. They did it with biotech stocks. They did it with a computer chip and so on technology. So all those were a bit of a fraud, but they did it. They don't have a segment today, but the segment should be and could be, of course, hydrogen technology. If you haven't read up on it, you can just use hydrogen. It's in water, H2O, and you can generate power for your automobiles and your home. It would bring the cost of all this down to nothing, and you'd have no environmental problems. It just turns back to water once you've used it. Do you think an oil man like George Bush is going to push this new technology and revitalize our economy? I don't believe so. Your caller is dead right.
I think that's a fascinating thing to contemplate, John. You're absolutely right. Anything else you'd like to say?
I got a quick practical question. Bill Sardi is author of The Iron Time Bomb. I just love olives. I opened a can today, and I noticed they have a ferrous gluconate that's an iron-type-based color preservative. Is that a problem, or what should I do about that?
Yeah, they've got all these iron. The iron we get in foods between fortified foods and between what's in our diet. We don't need anything in food supplements, so please, no iron in your vitamins. If you're female and you're menstruating and you're having the 7 kids, you might need a little bit. Take it separately now and then. But watch out for this iron overload thing. It really is a problem. I wrote a whole book on it. For men, absolutely watch this. And, they lace it into things. We found. I had a man call me who actually went blind, and he was a chemist, and actually looked over his diet and found out that he was eating in the morning a cereal, whatever they call it, Kellogg something, that has 100% of your iron requirements in one bowl of cereal. Do you know any men who sit down and eat one bowl of cereal? They eat 3.5. And he was getting a couple of 100% of his iron requirements in one meal plus the rest of the day, and he went blind. And when he figured it out, he took it out of his diet, he got all of his vision back. So so believe me, it's lacing in there, and it's going to affect the men, and it makes you more prone to disease. By the way, bacteria, funguses, viruses all feed off of iron. So the iron load makes your disease worse. So be careful about iron.
Let me just suggest to the listeners, go up to Bill's website, AskBillSardi.com. He's got some great books up there. You'll really want to read them. And he's got one there about, what's the one about the Bible and what it says about...
Oh, yeah, well, we have a wonderful thing for the Christian community, and it's a wonderful labor of love that I prepared. It took me about 5 years to write, which is The Power of Healing, The Power of God. It has all the interesting stuff about the Bible and health and history of health and of course, all the way to the modern times, even deals with subjects like faith healing and of course, the collapse of modern medicine and what you need to do. Bring health care into the home. That's where it belongs. That's a wonderful book written for Christians. There's another book, How to Live 100 Years Without Growing Old. That's a wonderful new book out. I have a book on multivitamins. Those are all fun things I like to share with people. And, of course, we do get a lot of calls lately because of this anthrax issue and because of things, the winter months and the flu and the colds and the coughs. I have a lot of calls about this product called Alimax. This is this garlic pill brought in here from Britain. It's the only one with the active ingredient of real allicin in it that fresh garlic has. And lots of people have called, and I have to say it's been miraculous for eczema. It's been miraculous for acne. It's been miraculous for Epstein-Barr. I mean, some of these uncontrolled or untreatable conditions. And I just have to say, you have to try it. The manufacturer is in Britain, and he can't put any of those health claims on it. But I'm a journalist, and I get to tell people, hey, you might try it for this, because I'm getting some great feedback on this. By the way, they did a wonderful study. It was published. It showed it reduced the risk of the common cold in the winter months by over 50-60%. So that's called Alimax. Let me give you the manufacturer's number, because so many people have called me about it, and they're emailing me. And that's 866-405-4000. Now, they'll send you literature, or you may be interested in getting some for your medicine cupboard. I'm telling everyone, get some natural antibiotics at home. When you get sick, you don't have to run to the doctor and get prescriptions. Until you do, it gives you something to use. The oil of oregano is this wonderful Alimax capsule, fresh garlic in your home. Those are all natural antibiotics, and they do not develop antibiotic resistance. So, yeah. Get prepared.
Give me that telephone number once again.
That's 866-405-4000 for the Alimax capsules. That's the manufacturer from Britain, and they can help you with that.
Okay, anything else, John?
I wash my alums well. Bye now.
Okay, fine. Thanks, John. And let me just point out that my producer just brought in the website for Barbara Lowe Fisher, the Vaccine Center. It's 909shot.com. That's 909shot.com. So go up there and you'll find fascinating material on smallpox. I think Barbara's done an excellent job. Go to Bill Sardi's website, go to the CDC website and learn all these things. And, you know, I think it's absurd to start taking a vaccination when there has not been a case of smallpox in the world for 30 years. Now, that isn't to say that there not going to be a smallpox epidemic. Maybe that's why we stopped vaccinating people 30 years ago, when back about the time that the Club of Rome came out with a report on the limits of growth, saying there are too many people in the world, we're going to have to get rid of them. Well, we've got Neil calling from Spokane. Hi, Neil. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I'm doing well.
Is this the Neil that I've met on several occasions?
It is.
Okay, good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Have you talked to a farmer, say a wheat farmer? They certainly do not have a shortage of grains on the world market.
No, they're not.
You know, the prices have dropped because of the glut on the market.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right, but let me, as long as I've got you on the line, how are you coming with your institutes on the Constitution? Is that doing pretty well?
It's doing very well. We had our first continuing education meeting this past Tuesday.
You want to put out a telephone number so people will know how to get hold of you?
Yeah, it's 509-891-7428.
Give that one more time slowly.
509-891-7428.
And that's for the Institute of the Constitution. You need to learn about our Constitution, the foundation of our freedom.
Yeah. We have a class scheduled for Saturday, February 22nd, and Saturday, March 1st. And that will be at the Valley Library in Spokane. I'm sorry, the Argonne Library.
Okay, fine. Well, get in touch with Neil and start setting these up all over. You have to know what you're in favor of before you'll understand what you're against, and you have to understand America's godly heritage. Hey, God bless you. We're out of time. Thanks so much for calling, Neil.
You bet.
And let's, Bill, we're just about out of time. Do you have a quick message for our listeners before we have to let you go?
Well, I think, you know, the insecurity, we're at a time of insecurity, financial, health-wise, otherwise. I think we need to rely on God like our forefathers did. I think we need to develop some toughness. I think we need to get prepared like they did. They stocked up for problems. And, of course, you know, get a home antibiotic kit, get prepared, be ready, and I think you'll be able to handle these challenges.
And keep your eyes fixed on the Lord. God
Absolutely.
Bless you. Thanks so very much,
you
Bill.
Bet.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and now, of course, we're going to have to say goodbye to our listeners in the Great Northwest. And, of course, please pray for America. And remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Don't get discouraged because God is still in control. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because we have with us right now Michael Milligan. He's the author of The Pine Field Killing, and it's a fascinating book. I've enjoyed reading it. I, got started yesterday, and I just about finished the book. It's one of these fast-moving adventure stories, but it's really, it's all about an environmentalist movement, and when I first got started reading it, I thought, they're on the side of the environmentalists, but by the time I got into the book a short ways, I began to realize that there was a great deal of just practical wisdom here. And, of course, it was really an effort to expose much of the fraudulent material we get through the controlled medium and, of course, through the controlled information that is programmed into the minds of the average American. Michael, I understand that you actually were a tree grower?
Yes, Doctor, I sure was.
Are you still growing Christmas trees?
No, we closed down the farm after a while. It was just getting too unprofitable.
Well, of course, your book is called The Pine Field Killings. So why don't you go ahead and tell us about it, how you happened to write that, and what this really is all about. What's the message you're trying to get to the American people?
Well, I think I did a slow burn after the Alar scare. I don't know if you remember that. It was back in 1989.
Yeah, I remember that. That was when they were talking about how you couldn't eat the apples because it had Alar on them, and they just destroyed the whole apple industry for that that year. And there was no truth to it at all, but then there's no truth to much of what they tell us.
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of these big environmental groups are pretty good at whipping up scary headlines and creating panics.
Say, are you on a regular hard-held telephone?
No, I'm on a headset here.
Could you get onto a regular telephone for us?
Sure.
Because this just doesn't have good clarity.
Okay, hang on.
Okay, fine. And so we'll get Michael back out here.
Okay, is that better?
Oh, that is just like the difference between night and day.
Okay. I think a lot of those big environmental groups are great at whipping up scary headlines and creating panics, but I really don't think they're very good at simple math. Like how we're going to feed the Earth's people while preventing massive destruction of wild land. And a lot of these environmental leaders, I believe, that are here now, are products of the old New Left of the 1960s. And they're still using the same MO, scaring people to gain power.
But, of course, the trouble is, Michael, most people don't understand, where does the money come from? The money comes from the great tax-exempt foundations, and many times the great corporations, and you find many of the great timber corporations funding these radical left-wing organizations, the Ted Turners of this world, the largest or second-largest property owner of a wilderness area in the country, Ted Turner, funding the environmentalists. And, of course, going along with that is the instructions there not to bother him.
Yeah, right. Well, so, I think that's half the battle. Like, if you ever listen to NPR, I think it's kind of like a protection racket.
Sure it is, and that's exactly what it's all about. But tell us now, you were growing up, were you growing Christmas trees or regular trees?
As I was growing up?
No, I mean, didn't you have a tree ranch?
Yeah, as I was growing.
Okay.
It was Christmas trees.
Okay, and Christmas.
Earlier on, I had a market gardening business where I also grew shade trees, but that was a much smaller operation.
Okay, and of course, the Christmas tree business, at least in some areas, is pretty good, but what have they done? Just put so many rules and regulations on it here in California, you make your life miserable?
Oh, they do that. They sure do. They do that for any farmer. You know, there's always the normal problems of farming, which are weather and the markets. And those can be doozies, and that's what pretty much put us out of business.
Well, did you sell your land, or what did you do?
Well, we were leasing land down here, but the market would go up and it would come down. Right now it's up, so anybody that stayed in is going to be in pretty good shape, but it'll turn around like a cow-calf cycle. When the meat prices get really high, everybody and their cousin starts breeding cattle. And before long, the prices are down again. So.
And that's what happens with the Christmas trees. I know my
son...
Yeah,
it's a much slower cycle.
Right. My son wholesales Christmas trees out of Oregon. And, you know, of course, when the prices are high, everybody plants their trees. And 5 years later, there's a glut of Christmas trees.
Yeah, that's for sure.
What does it take, about 5 years to grow a good Christmas tree? Eight years?
Down here, we were growing Monterey pines. Which is a pretty fast-growing tree. We could get an 8 to 10 foot tree in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
But up in the higher lands, higher elevations, where it could grow fir trees, the cycle's more like 7 or 8 years.
Okay.
It's hanging on. The ones they didn't sell, say at 8 years, they could hang on till 12 years and sell them for a premium.
All right. For our listeners, the book is entitled The Pine Field Killing. And it's the story of a tree farmer. Of course, I suspect the prototype was our author, Michael Milligan. And, of course, why somebody is killed in his field by a pesticide. And he is accused of using an illegal pesticide and being responsible for the death. And it's a fast-moving adventure story against this backdrop of the environmental people who are really trying to use this whole issue for their own aggrandizement and creating issues and creating, of course, in the story, they're actually killing people, and they really have done terrible things. We've got these eco freaks who are out there burning down ski lodges, as they've done in Colorado, up in Oregon, where they'll burn down a whole lot full of SUVs, or they'll burn down a whole housing development. And the amazing thing is, in most instances, the police are told to leave them alone. And that's a big problem, that in many areas the police know what's going on, but the orders come from the top, let them do what they do, exactly as they did when the environmentalists were up there at the riots in Seattle. And the mayor gave orders to the police, do not interfere as they burn our town.
Yeah.
And then only when things got really out of hand did they allow the police to go in. And by that time, why the police have to go in their riot gear. And then you've got this television spectacle of the police with their helmets on looking like Darth Vader. And, you know, and the whole thing is staged for the public to make people think that there are two sides in the issue, and they inflame the idealists who are in the crowd against the police and the police against that. And it's the old Hegelian dialectic. And, of course, the real purpose is this whole thing is being manipulated from above, including specifically the mayor of Seattle, who had actually invited the environmentalists in, put a big party on for him the night before, and then told the police not to maintain law and order.
Yeah, a real smart move, wasn't it?
Right. No, he knew exactly what he was doing. It was just the average person across America didn't know. And if you're out there and you haven't heard my video, pardon me, my four-tape set on the battle in Seattle, or seen our newsletter on that, you really need to get it to understand. Well, do the environmentalists threaten America today?
Oh, I think they threaten it enormously. You know, the world population's growing at a pretty good clip. In fact, it grew from a pretty good clip from, say, 1940 to 1980. It tripled, in fact. And fortunately, the agricultural production tripled at the same time. And it also tripled without increasing the acreage at all. So, you know, that was perfect, but it was because of agricultural technology, a lot of, you know, useful agricultural technology. Well, if these guys get their way and want to outlaw pesticides and other important agricultural processes, what are we going to do? You know, it looks, they're talking about maybe 8.5 billion people on the earth in the mid-20th century. And if that's the case, we still have to triple it again.
Well, now, you made a couple of points in your book, something about, you know, a lot of our fruits and vegetables have natural pesticides in them.
Right.
Why don't you touch on that? Because, of course, nature created a lot of pesticides that are inherent to, you know, to things. In fact, one of the pesticides you talked about was made from a flower, and of course, it actually kills or discourages the worms. What was that one?
That was called pyrethroid.
Pyrethrin
is the native.
And where does that come from?
It comes from a daisy.
From a daisy, and you actually spray that on the trees, and that would be there for a time and would kill off a certain number of the worms?
Yeah, it helps. It's not perfect. A longer persisting pesticide would have been much better, because as I tried to describe in the book, that these moths fly over a period of a week or so, and these pesticides might only be good for a day or two, so you might kill the moths that fly in the middle of the generation, and the ones that survive on either side, on the early flying ones and the late flying ones, come back to haunt you. Whereas some of the older, more persistent pesticides would have killed the whole generation, and it would have never amounted to much of a problem.
And, of course, the thing is that they're trying to make us think that we're killing everybody with a pesticide. Some of them were incredibly safe, and those have been outlawed, and then they give us things that just don't work.
Yeah.
And they've outlawed the effective, safe pesticides in many instances with the faulty science, exactly like, you know, we find that the environmentalists are planting lynx hair or grizzly bear hair, and they're falsifying scientific studies. These people aren't really interested in anything but the disruption of modern society.
Yeah, and a lot of self-aggrandizement, I think.
Well, did you have any run-ins with the environmentalists when you were
actually, I guess you could say the Alar scare was something of a run-in, because right after that happened, there was a proposition in California, you probably remember, called the Big Green.
Okay, I think that was Tom Hayden, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was all those lunatics. It was a lot of movie stars, but it was they were going to correct everything in the kitchen sink. But the thing that concerned me mostly were a couple of pesticides that were critical for the production of my crop were on the hit list. If that thing passed, it would be they'd be dead in the water.
It did pass, didn't it?
No, it didn't.
It didn't. Okay,
no,
good.
It looked like it was, and they were promising it was going to pass, but a lot of interests, such as agriculture, got on the case and actually beat it by 70-30.
No, that was a state initiative?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad for that. But anyway, of course, they get a lot of things passed there at the state level, you know, through the legislature. And we've got one of the most radical legislatures in the entire world right here in California. And I'm including comparing it with the Soviet Union today.
Exactly.
We got probably more people who really believe in Marxism in Sacramento than they have in Moscow, because over there they know it's a fraud.
Yeah.
Here these people really believe they're going to be able to change the world through their intelligence.
Yeah, I think you should look at some of these organizations today, the environmental organizations, and they look a lot like Soviet apparatchiks sitting around a sauna enjoying the good vodka while all the peasants are out standing in line somewhere.
Yeah, they're the ones, of course, in Sacramento that say everybody has to drink fluoridated water because we want the children's teeth, but in all their offices they have bottled water with no fluoride in it.
Yeah,
now, science tells us that the pesticides cause cancer. Is that true? Or are there some pesticides that do cause cancer?
Well, there have only been a couple, really. One was lead arsenate, which was used way back when, before DDT, and obviously, it's not a good thing to use, and it's been outlawed. And then there was another with vinyl chloride, which uses a propellant for household bug sprays. And once they determined that that was actual human carcinogen, they ruled it out. But if you look at the others, it's a question of what are they calling a carcinogen?
Now, of course, you commented that sometimes they would feed some poor animal about 400,000 times the regular dose, and they would get cancer, and they'd say, see, you know, this is a carcinogen.
Yeah, that's exactly what they do. But then if you take the natural occurring chemicals that occur in unsprayed fruits and vegetables, the chemicals that nature provides the plant to protect itself from disease and insects, and do the same tests with those chemicals, you get exactly the same results, that 50% of them are so-called carcinogens. But the problem is that with the mouse test, of feeding a mouse this inordinate amount of anything, you could take, they feed it maybe 40,000 times the amount that a human would ever consume, and then they make deductions about that. And they say, well, okay, if we got this result at 40,000 times the normal dose, then can we figure that one out of every 40,000 people are going to get it at the normal dose? But if you think about it, it's like saying, giving somebody 40,000 aspirins a day and saying, oh my God, look at all the side effects. And then they make the conclusion that, well, out of all the population, one out of 40,000 people taking one aspirin a day are going to have that side effect. It's preposterous. It was never proven, and it's totally refuted by modern toxicologists, but still they use it, especially for these scares.
And really, this is really what it's all about. They use science, and you know, these people should ought to be ashamed of themselves. But the people who really ought to be ashamed of themselves are the people who are supposedly scientists in our universities, that, oh, we are scientists and we're here to determine the truth. And they lie, and they lie because they have a political agenda. We've seen this, of course, in so many things. You know, when I went to college, why, everybody knew the Piltdown Man was the missing link. That was scientific. Everybody knew it. Every scientist accepted. The only thing, it was a fraud. And before that, it was the Nebraska Man. And all the scientists wanted that to believe that. Because, of course, the one thing they did not want to believe is there was a God. And so they accepted things that were totally fraudulent. And the tragedy is you can't trust most scientists because they have a political agenda. And until we have men who will study issues independently and seek the truth, which is what science is really all about, rather than use their platform to push an agenda, why, we will continue having the serious, serious problems we have today.
Yeah. Who was it that... I think it was G.K. Chesterton said that, you know, if you don't have good science, if you don't have objective science, and people can't trust that it's good objective science, it's not that they won't believe nothing, it's that they will believe anything.
Right.
And I think that's pretty much the case. That's why these guys can come along and sell just about any old bill of goods they want.
Now, tell us about organic farming. You've been a farmer. Is organic farming practical? Is it worthwhile? You know, only thing I know about organic products is they cost more, and they've the tomatoes have a little bit of vine on the top of them.
Mm-hmm. It's practical in a small situation. If somebody wants to go to a store and buy organic produce, that's fine. But if someone starts legislating that we're going to not use pesticides, for example, it's going to be terrible for the world's population, because we have, right now, using pesticides and modern technology, we can meet the needs, you know, and we have to keep growing that technology to meet the oncoming needs by the mid 21st century. There's going to be three times the amount of people, two or three times the amount of people there are today. And going backwards in time isn't going to do any good. And basically, that's what it is. If you look at the farm production statistics for 1940, I think I said this before, and then look at them in 1980, we tripled our production. If you went back to the 1940 production techniques, then you would have to triple the amount of cultivated land just to have the same amount of food we do today.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that there really are people who want to do exactly what you're saying, do away with pesticides. For our listeners out there, if you have not yet read the Global Biodiversity Assessment, came out of Cambridge University Press. It was actually, of course, a byproduct of the Global Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. And they say we've got to do away with pesticides and fertilizer and herbicides, and then they say most people think that would produce shortages of food, and that's bad. But of course, we feel it's going to produce shortages of food, and that's good.
That's right.
And you wonder, what are these people talking about?
And
what they're really talking
about
is they're going to kill off a large part of the world's population.
Exactly. That's the only alternative.
And if you don't believe it, you need to get their material or get our summary. You can get it in our Sustainable Development Syllabus. We've summarized what they wrote, what came out of the Global Biodiversity Assessment, 1,142 pages down to about 40. But you have to understand there are people who have a different view of the world. And when you understand that, it all makes sense. You look at a glass, it's half filled. You say, gee, that's half full. And they say, no, it's half empty.
Yeah.
And you know, two people can look at that same glass and have an entirely different approach. And because that glass is half empty, why, we're going to have to start conserving water and rationing water to people. And, you know, you hear this, you know, there's a shortage of water in Saudi Arabia. That's why we've got to do something about the shortage of water in America. And you say, you're talking about apples and oranges. And yet, of course, they're convincing us that there's really shortages of water, and then they do everything they can to block any efforts to prevent shortages of water and salt water intrusion. And all of these things are carefully calculated, playing on the emotions of the American people. Well, what about the entangled relationships between the environmental activists, the trial lawyers, the politicians, and the press?
Well, Everybody, I think, has a pretty good idea that the press likes scary headlines because it sells papers, and the more papers you sell, the more advertising you sell. And so that's a pretty common knowledge. And so they play into the hands, in a way, of the scaremongers, environmentalists. And the trial lawyers, they like it because, in the case of, say, Ralph Nader, they pass so many laws that the more laws you have, the easier it is for a trial lawyer to set up a case with somebody and line his own pockets. Some of the richest people in the law in the U.S. aren't some Ivy League lawyers. They're just a bunch of unheard-of trial lawyers who are making $500 million a year. And so, I don't know, I guess that about sums it up. And I think also the media is has, you know where their inclinations are. Like William Buckley said, about 30 years ago, a new school of journalism began to emerge, and that its adherents of the 60s mostly believe the truth is relative and even secondary to the advocacy of their political agenda. And so when you have people like that, how are you even going to get the truth? That's what's so troubling, and that's part of the motivation for me writing this book.
Well, tell us a little bit about writing the book. Where did you get the idea for the book? I mean, it's a fast-moving adventure story involving violence and a little bit of sex, but mostly, the environmental issue, the relationship between the hero, who's a fellow named Redman, and this reporter, who's an honest reporter, trying to get to the bottom of it, and, of course, the murder and violence and marijuana growers, and of course, these wacko environmentalists. Some of them are sincere. Many of them, of course, have a political agenda. Where did you get the idea for this whole fast-moving story?
Well, it was, I think a lot of it spawned, at that time that I was driving my tractor, thinking about all the laws that the Proposition 128 was threatening, and plus all the state regulations you described from the state of California, and just feeling really oppressed. And, when the Alar scare came around, my first reaction, I started out as an organic home gardener, trying to be Mr. Good Guy. But slowly as I went into it commercially, I had to start using some pesticides and then more pesticides. So I really got upset when all this stuff happened. I thought, man, have I been duped? So I started reading on it, and the more I read, the more angry I got. So there I am sitting out there on the tractor, thinking about these characters and what they're pulling on us, 100-degree weather and a plasticized spray suit. And, man, it makes it easy to make you want to think of, murder plots. I don't know why, but for some reason, thoughts of evening the score kind of came through my head. And I always liked murder mysteries. So I thought, this might be a good way to make my point.
And so when did you write the book?
Oh, I started it in 93. And believe me, it took me about 7 years. It's not just sitting down and writing a book. It's sitting down and learning how to write a novel. And it's not a small task. It's like any other learning curve. It's big. So I went to UCLA, took some novel writing courses there, and then I also took some screenwriting courses because I thought in some ways they helped a little better with the drama than just the novel courses by themselves did. And then I met with a bunch of, at the school there, I met with a bunch of people who are also writing mysteries, and we got together once a week and read each other's stuff, and that was an enormous help.
Well, you for somebody who's never written anything of this magnitude before, you did an excellent job. It's a exciting book to read, and of course, it really holds you. You want to get to the next page and find out what's going to happen next, because something's always happening.
Well, everybody seems to like it so far.
How long has it been out now?
Oh, I think it came out in November.
And how is it moving? Are you getting a fair number of sales on it?
It's really too hard to say yet. Trying to get the information back from the publisher, but I think it's going to do all right.
Well, at least he's trying, and they've got people calling me and arranging for your interview.
Uh-huh.
The book is The Pinefield Killing by Michael Milligan. How can people get the book?
The cheapest and easiest way is to go to the publisher's website, which is pinefieldkilling.com. Pinefieldkilling.com. And you can find it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all those places, but it will cost you more and won't come quite as quickly.
All right, fine. That's the pinefieldkilling.com. Of course, our guest is Michael Milligan. If you have any questions out there about simply the pesticides and the fertilizers, the herbicides, and all of these things which are so much in the news today, and, of course, all the efforts to get us just scared to death about we're all going to die from the pesticides, give us a call here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Maybe you can answer me some questions. One of the big things today is, of course, all the talk about the genetically modified corn and specifically the corn and other grains that now, and of course, down in Africa, why the people are starving and the government won't let them take the American grain because some of it has been genetically altered. What are they talking about, genetically altered? Are there complications? Are there problems with that? What can you tell us about it?
Well, you know, I wish I were more of an expert on it, but I'm not. I have done some reading, and the most interesting reading, I think, is from Norman Borlaug. He's a 1970 Nobel Peace Prize winner he was basically the father of the Green Revolution.
Right. And, of course, this was a genetically modified product, wasn't it? It was rice, basically, that it's allowed, of course, the people in the Asia and the Orient to feed their population.
Well, I think back then it was just normal pollination techniques. I'm not positive, though. Like I say, I wish I were better schooled on that than I am. But he did a magnanimous. I read his biography, and it was just stunning what this guy did. He was working from the 40s till right through the 70s, and while people like Paul Ehrlich and all these guys were talking about starvation in 1975, this guy was out there plugging away, and he headed off starvation. He and a group of very dedicated people headed off starvation in the third world by introducing modern technology. But the interview I read with him, he thinks that that's the only way we're going to make that next tripling of the world food supply, and I think what it amounts to is things like having crops that are resistant, have a built-in resistant gene to, say, something like the herbicide Roundup, which is a very innocuous herbicide, The idea is they can go ahead and plant the crop, and rather than come in and trying to cultivate it and all this, they can just spray right over the top. It'll kill all the little weed seedlings coming up around the crop is without damaging the crop. This will save tremendous amounts of fuel, and I think, and then there are other things too for improved resistance to insects. I know there's the Bacillus thuringiensis that they're trying to breed into corn, I think, to protect it from, when you open an ear of corn, you see the worms up there at the top.
Yeah, right.
Corn earworms. And there are other things. There are other worm-type crops, or worm-type pests that will get into corn. And this will kill them, but it's a very safe. I know it probably worries some people, but the Bacillus thuringiensis, for it to be toxic, you have to have a very, very alkaline stomach. I think like a pH of 9 or something like that, for it to be toxic. That's why it works on worms, but it doesn't work on humans or other creatures.
All right, we're going to be back here in just 3 minutes, so you got 3 minutes to catch your breath. Okay.
Okie doke.
Okay. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you listen to our programs regularly, you know what our basic theme is. We're involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And, of course, if we approach it purely from a political point of view, we're going to lose, or even purely ideologically. Now, politics is important, and we should be involved, and ideologically, we have to know what we believe in, and certainly the culture, American culture is in crisis today. But behind everything going on today are these spiritual, dark spiritual forces, which of course date back to the beginning of time, and of course are energizing the various forces at work in America today. And of course, those of you who haven't seen the emblem on the DARPA website, the Pentagon website, where the Defense Intelligence Organization is working, Admiral Poindexter's website, where of course they have, and they took the emblem of the secret societies off the back of the dollar bill, and they put it on that website, the pyramid capped by the all-seeing eye, the glorified eye, looking out over the world. And if you haven't seen that, we got it here. Some people say it's been pulled down off of some of the websites. It may still be on some of the other websites. But the audacity of these people to take that emblem of the secret societies, figuring the American people are so dumb, we can put it on the back of the dollar bill, they're not concerned. We can put it on the back of the Great Seal of the United States, the American people aren't concerned. We can even flaunt our power and the power of the mystery religions right up there on the web, on this DARPA website. And, of course, we can spit in their face, and they'll think it's due. Well, I hope that more and more Americans will begin to understand the true nature of the battle and will join with us in this epic struggle. And if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Or if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, the December newsletter deals with the occult foundation of our world's, of our nation's monetary system, really of the world monetary system, because the American dollar is the basis of the world monetary system. Why, of course, that's the December newsletter. Takes you back into the Knights Templar and, of course, these various forces working behind the scenes. So if you'd like to get a free copy of my newsletter and haven't had one before, just give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and tell others about our programs. Tell others about our website at RadioLiberty.com, where, of course, our programs can be heard on the Internet, 3 hours live every day and 2 hours linked to other programs, and then, of course, our archive programs. Help us to get the truth out across America, because that's what we need to do, and we need your help to do it. We can't do it on our own, but if you will join us, why, and help tell others, encourage them to listen, get them books and copies of our audio programs. You're welcome to copy anything we have. Get them to start listening to the, reading our newsletters, and hopefully little by little they'll come to understand the truth of what you're trying to tell them. So again, remember our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Remember our website, RadioLiberty.com. And of course, we'll look forward to having you with us to the rest of the program, and again tomorrow night and every night here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Michael Milligan, and of course, you're talking about his book, The Pine Tree, The Pine Field Killing, The Pine Field Killing. It's a fast-moving adventure story, and this is your first novel, isn't it, Michael?
Yes, it sure is.
Well, of course, I hope it's not your last. I think you've got a talent there, and I think you want to use this. What are you doing now since you got out of farming? How are you making a living these days?
Well, I took some of the money I had saved up and spent 2 years working full-time trying to finish that novel, at which point I ran out of money and went into doing web design work. Web development, which I've been a computer hobbyist the whole time I was farming, so it wasn't too rough a transition. And hopefully at some point I'll sell enough books I can turn that into a trade.
Okay, fine. Well, I hope you will. And of course, I find, of course, we've written a couple of books, but we have a little mail order business. I find the more you have to sell, the more you're gonna, the more people will buy. So the more books you write, why, the more people will be buying them from you.
Yeah, I've got another one that I'd like to bring out on the more on the left of the 60s and how it impacts us today. I think it's going to be a really good book, because I was back in those days before I had grown up. I was one of them, and I think I can shed a lot of light on what that generation in that era has wrought for us today.
Well, of course, a lot of these people were very, very sincere. And of course, they, many of them opposed the Vietnam War. And I think they were right, but they opposed the war for the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, that they didn't understand the geopolitics. They didn't understand what was going on. And I think that many of us, of course, who supported that no-win war, have thought very seriously about its implications and, of course, carrying that over to what will be happening here in the next few weeks as we move into a war with Iraq. We ask, what is this really all about and where is the outcry? And of course, many of the people, you know, who were involved in this left-wing movement really wanted to destroy America, not understanding the foundations of our freedom or the fact we had drifted so far from those foundations. So I think that it would be well worthwhile to explore that and then to find out what was good, what was bad about the that movement.
Yeah, there were a lot of, I agree with you, there were the majority were very sincere, but there was an awful lot of very manipulative people.
Oh, well, there are people like David Horowitz, who, of course, published Rampart's magazine. He was a hardline communist, and he certainly came from a communist family, and he, of course, led that so much of what happened at that time. But we actually have some of the people of that generation who are still listening to our program, who still adhere to many of the beliefs. And I don't criticize what they believe. They want a better world, and they see what's happening in our society, and they realize the problems in our society, but they're not necessarily involved with us in trying to do something about it. You can't just criticize. You've got to take your place on the front lines of the battle. Each one of us has to, in whatever possible way we can. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Michael Milligan. His book, The Pine Field Killing. Now, what can the American people do to combat these environmentalists, these people who are manipulating our government, who are manipulating the media, who are manipulating the American people, and, of course, spewing lies forth, and, of course, proposing an environmental movement whose purpose has nothing to do with the environment. It is an agenda that really involves the destruction of Western civilization as we know it.
Yeah, my best suggestion is to be very careful of the science you read. And I think if you read it through a lot of mainstream magazines and television, you're going to get some pretty bad stuff. I ended up going through places like Fortune Magazine, the London Economist. I can't even think of them all, but I did 6 months of just incredibly intensive research. Went to libraries, you know, if it's something that, well, and it may be a bit much for the average person to go through. I was going through it because I was so concerned. That may be the problem, is that it's all, people feel like it only peripherally, if at all, affects them, and aren't maybe willing to go do that extra work to find out what the facts are.
Well, of course, we still carry Barry Clausen's excellent book, Burning Rage, which goes into the background of these environmental organizations. And, of course, people do not really understand that behind this whole movement are these people of great wealth who have, of course, a different vision of the world. And really, so much of this goes back to the Club of Rome and their book, The Limits of Growth, which was published in 1972. And it basically laid out this whole concept of sustainable development and this whole idea that there are too many people in the world, and the only solution to the problems of modern civilization was to destroy modern civilization.
Yeah.
And, of course, people say, well, that's crazy talk. And, of course, if you read what these people say, you'd think they were stark raving mad. And so, yet these are some of the most wealthy and powerful men in the world. People like Maurice Strong. And, of course, Stephen Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Mikhail Gorbachev, former dictator of Russia. And why are they all working together for this same common goal, same common cause? And this is what I think, why a lot of people sort of shake their heads and it's so complicated. They sort of figure that they can't figure it out, so they just sort of ignore it. But they can't because, of course, the very future of civilization hangs by a thread today.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that I read was that as countries, and I think we know this from our own country, as the country becomes wealthier, its population does not grow so fast. And as the modern technology, the agricultural technology, and increase of wealth has happened to third world countries, their population has fallen significantly. I can't remember the exact amount, or the exact dates, but it fell from six, I think it was 1960, it was six children per woman, to where it's now about a little bit under three children per woman.
Well, certainly in the United States, it's 2.1 person children per woman. And if you go to France, it's 1.4 children. And you go to Italy, it's 1.2 children. Same in Russia. These populations are dying off. And the only populations that are really growing are the Muslim populations. And if it doesn't change, why, they'll be soon speaking Arabic all across Europe. And
yeah,
there will be no European population. And this is a direct product of this whole global population control agenda that has been programmed into the people. And, of course, with that becomes the apathy and indifference, and then the unconcern about the important values in life, which are God and family and country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of which, one of the reasons I wrote the book the way I did is a lot of literature now, you know, really likes to hang out in the shade of gray. Everything, you know, and this guy's really not so bad, and the good guy's really not so good. And I just totally reject that. I think there's just bad, evil in the world. And that's part of why I wrote the book the way I did. I just figured my bad guys are bad guys. There's no way.
Well, boy, are they bad guys.
Yeah. Why pull your punches? I mean, you know, they can go to give a life history of why this person's murdering somebody, but that evil is evil.
Right. Well, there really is. And, of course, Fox is one of your characters. He is really rotten down to the very core.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, the plight of many of the Mexican laborers who are here in America, I think you bring that out very, very dramatically. And a lot of these people are good, hardworking people, and, of course, they can be exploited. If they're working for honest people, why, fine. But certainly the drug underground, which we have, permeates every aspect of the state. You know, of course, we know that certainly in major parts of the state, one of the largest crops is marijuana.
Yeah, that's right. It was a pretty sizable crop. I think it was, I forget, I read the statistics a long time ago, but it was like $1 billion or something. I think the entire agricultural production for California, which at that time was its largest industry, was about 16, 18 billion, something like that.
Well, don't let Governor Davis know about that. He'll want to get a tax share of that as well. You know?
He may be one of them selling it. I don't know.
Right.
But, you know, another part of the reason I wrote it the way I did is I just did not understand how people can be so off base. And I have a sneaking suspicion that drug-addled minds have something to do with it. You know, I just cannot help but think, how can somebody be so hornswoggled by some of these things that come down the pike unless they're stoned?
Well, some of them are stoned. Some of them have, you know, done permanent damage to their mind by prolonged use of marijuana. Some people can smoke a little marijuana. It doesn't do any harm. But prolonged use over a long period of time really can produce definite personality changes. Now, whether those are reversible or not, I'm really not certain. But I certainly know that many of the drug changes went with LSD or not. But there is another element there. And then there are some people, as we said earlier, who have a different worldview. And I think one of the hardest things for people to accept is that there are some people who have no apparent conscience, no sense of right and wrong as we see it. Everything, of course, is relative. There are no absolutes. And to them, why, of course, if you can get away with it, do it. And those are the people I really worry about. And the tragedy is many of these people have accumulated great wealth and, of course, are financing the environmental movement or in the leadership of the environmental movement. And they just look at the world differently than rational people.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, you've done a lot of hard work. Being a farmer is just plain hard work. There's just no way around that. And a lot of these people have never done hard work. They're the product of a liberal upbringing and a liberal education, and they were educated far beyond their intelligence when they were in college. And they have yet not seen the world as it really is.
You know, I tell you what, I always like farming because besides being kind of a solitary person, I just think that, you know, if you get a job as a lawyer or salesman, something like that, there's always, you know, you can always hoodwink a human. But if you get a job working on plants, either you don't hoodwink a plant. You know, either you give it what it needs, you take care of it, and it thrives, or there's no middle ground. And so I always felt really good about that in the sense that it was such a strong reality check. I just, you know, I knew if I was doing my job, that plant was growing. And whereas, you know, some sneaky lawyer, you know, he can get pretty much get away with whatever he can get away with.
Well, now, were you growing the pine trees for Christmas trees, or were you growing them for lumber, or what?
For pine, for Christmas trees.
Okay, fine.
We had, people would come out, and families would come out and pick their own trees and cut it down and haul it off.
Now, did you actually go ahead and trim them as well?
Oh, yeah. That was the biggest part of the job. We'd
shear the trees. And
yeah. We were up to 78 acres of trees at one point, which, you know, say compared to a lot of farms in the country, that's not much, but for a choose-and-cut Christmas tree farm, that was, I think, the biggest farm in Southern California at the time. And we would just start shearing on one end, and by the time we got to the other end, it was time to go back up and start over again.
Well, did you have a crew working with you, or what?
Yeah, I had about four guys working with me. Pretty nice, really nice Mexican guys, hard-working guys. They were all legal.
Right.
But, it was nice. It was nice experience to get to know them, too, and that's, I think, where Chewy came from.
Well, because I had a feeling that you didn't have much use for the bureaucrats who were supervising the environmental rules and regulations. Did you have some run-ins with these guys?
The first time I ever went out and sprayed Roundup, killing weeds out around the curbs of our farm, one of these guys came up and socked me with a $100 fine because I wasn't wearing gloves, you know, which I didn't know at the time. And I said, God, could you, you know, give me some slack? Not a big thing, and I suspected, you know. And I got to like him and his coworkers over a period of time, but I'd also hear stories. I don't know if you remember the one story about this poor fellow up in, I think it was the Bakersfield area, that went out and disc up his field and managed to...
He killed the kangaroo rats?
Yeah, Fish and Game came out and found a couple body parts from a kangaroo rat, and they seized his tractor and did all kinds of things. And I don't know what the outcome was, but I know I went to a demonstration up there with a lot of farmers that were protesting the seizure of this guy and trying to put him out of business. There was another instance, too, where some fella had taken an empty pesticide container and buried it, I guess, out behind his barn, which is not approved, probably for good reason. But instead of just fining him or whatever, they threw him in the pokey for 18 months. I suspect that sentence got commuted somehow or altered, but it just seemed like they were just so heavy-handed.
Well, I think this is one of the problems, is that power corrupts, and power corrupts absolutely everyone, and power specifically corrupts bureaucrats.
Yeah.
And, of course, what they want to do is make examples of people to intimidate everybody else and get them to go along. And, you know, certainly I don't think that burying a pesticide container may be the best idea in the world, but I don't think he's going to contaminate the groundwater, by doing it. And, you know, here we have something as toxic as fluoride, you know, that they really have to put into toxic dumps. Instead, they dump it into our water, you know, and they get away with that because they pay off the politicians.
Mm.
And yet, of course, some individual poor little guy who's farming out there, you know, dumps a little oil on the ground, or dumps a little insecticide on the ground, and, of course, they make a big issue out of it.
Yeah, you drain motor oil out in the ground, you can go to jail.
And yet, of course, where does oil come from? It comes from the ground.
Right.
And, of course, you know, you get it on the ground, and the bacteria come in, they gobble the thing up.
That's right. It doesn't last for long. Oh, well, it's a funny world.
Well, it's a funny world, and it's just happened because people have forgotten, you know, that the basis of freedom is property rights. And when somebody can come in and regulate your property rights, why? And when we let them do that, why, of course, we turn our back on this concept of life, liberty, and property, which are the foundations of our individual freedom. And they've forgotten that, of course, you will never see in the Constitution the words life and liberty without associated the word property. And of course, the tragedy is most of Americans don't understand our Constitution, and of course, most of the bureaucrats and most of the politicians never even bothered to read the Constitution.
Right.
And of course, in an authoritarian society, whatever the bureaucrat says becomes law. And of course, the trouble is that they themselves are the lawbreakers, because when you violate the Constitution, which is the foundation of society, why, you become far more a danger than, of course, the individual who creates a minor misdemeanor.
I agree wholeheartedly. They don't teach it in school.
No, and of course, this is what we do through our ministry, is try to get people to learn about the Constitution. We got to actually put on, I think, a series of programs here in the not-too-distant future. We've done it before. We have a wonderful four-tape set. It's called The Foundations of Our Freedom, that goes through the Constitution. But I think that we'll actually maybe get Dr. Eidsmo on and just do a series of evening programs, 2 hours an evening, over a period of maybe 3 or 4 days, and actually go through the whole Constitution, and really not only the facts, the structure of the Constitution, but of course it's a biblical heritage, because of course all the ideas are basically were based upon the Bible and God's law. And of course, when men begin making laws without looking to God for their inspiration, why, that's of course what tyranny is made of.
Yeah.
Well, what is the basic message that you want to get out through your writing? How do you hope this is going to impact European people? Do you think it's going to entertain them? Is that why you wrote it? Or did you wrote it to give them a message as well?
Well, for both. When I started writing it, I knew that if it wasn't a good, exciting read, that I might as well not bother. So as I started out, it was a lot more polemical than what it ended up being. But I just thought better ease into this a little more slowly. I just think that the liberal forces in society have a monopoly on fiction, both in the movies and in writing, and I don't know why that should be.
Well, because they got all the money, because they are organized, because they are dedicated, because most people just want to leave their lives and be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
People on the other side, of course, intend to take power because they understand how the game is played. And most people, they just want to enjoy life, and the other side wants to control them. And
exactly.
The people who are the most dedicated will win in a society like this. I mean, if you have a race and one group is running as hard as it can, the other people aren't running at all, you know who's going to win that race. And that's why we're on the mess we are today. Right here in California, we've got one of the most, as I mentioned earlier, we've probably got more Marxists up there in Sacramento than they have in Moscow.
Yeah. Yeah, well, with great talk shows like yours, I think, you know, we've got a chance here.
Well, we just need to get a lot wider coverage, but we have... 5 different talk shows every day, 5 different audiences every day, 7 different audiences every week. So that gives us at least somewhat of an outreach across America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that opens it up, and at least if somebody were to wade in and to try to do something like write a non-politically correct novel 5 or 10 years ago, they would just been pilloried. And I may be yet. I don't know.
Well, now, Chris, have you been doing quite a bit of talk radio?
A little bit, getting started here.
All right, fine. Well, I will tell you that the people who are handling your scheduling, your interviews are doing a good job for you. A very nice presentation, and then, of course, a good follow-up on it, which is so important, in something like this, getting the book to the host so we can read it, so we'll have something to say for an hour is an important part of
this. Appreciative that you read it, and most of them don't.
Well, I feel that's the ultimate insult not to read a book if it's sent to me. And you learn how to read books very, very quickly in this business, either that or you don't survive. And and not only that, but I really think that it's not fair to you, it's not fair to the audience, because then, of course, we're not going to be talking about anything significant. And your book is really trying to tell a story. And as in addition to a fast-moving adventure novel, you're trying to get people to understand that this whole environmental movement is being misused. Not that there isn't, I think most of us are environmentalists. Most of us want, of course, to see the beautiful forests. And yet, what are they doing up in so many areas, you know, in New Mexico and in the north, up in Idaho? I mean, they're preventing the people from going in and cutting down dead trees, of which, of course, leaves the forest tinder, so that the, you know, that there's going to be fires there, and the animals that they're so concerned about are going to be killed.
Well, I think a lot of these guys never see anything in nature except through maybe PBS.
Well, I think a lot of them know exactly, I think that some of the leaders know exactly what they're doing, because if you won't allow people to go in and take out blighted trees that have a disease, it's just going to keep spreading. I mean, you stop the blight by destroying the trees and burning that area. But, of course, they won't let them do that because they really want to destroy the forest. After all, forests are used to build houses, to put people in. Wouldn't it be better, of course, if you didn't have all those people? And it's hard for people to understand, but there really are people out there who do have a different worldview. Well, what are your parting thoughts for our listeners tonight?
Maybe just from what you were saying, I take offense from these so-called environmentalists calling themselves environmentalists like the rest of us aren't. I can think of nothing more pleasurable than when I was farming is sitting on that tractor, disking down weeds, and watching this old coyote do wide circles around me. And every time I'd disk a little bit more weeds down, I'd see this rabbit break from the brush, and boy, that coyote would be right on him. And every day I'd see that kind of stuff, and I really loved the land, and I had serious respect for it, and knew that it was my livelihood. And for somebody to portray me as something less than them, when they probably haven't left their apartment in New York, you know, and never even been out on off pavement, I just found that really repulsive, and that was a big motive for me to write this book. And hopefully, if I don't do anything else with this book, if I can at least give people some idea what it's like to be a farmer, because there aren't that many farmers in the U.S. anymore, and if I could get people to just see things through a farmer's eyes, I'd be tickled pink.
Well, God bless you. Thank you so very much, Michael. I appreciate you writing the book. I appreciate you being with us tonight.
Well, bless you, Doctor. I really appreciate you having me on.
Good night.
Take care.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and that was Michael Milligan. I hope you enjoyed our interview, and I think it's an excellent book. It's called The Pine Field Killing by Michael Milligan, and of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, and we ask you to pray for revival because, well, after all, if we don't turn back to God, God is going to turn his back on America. And perhaps that's what's going to happen in the near future. But anyway, until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Marie. Thank you for getting that website for me.
Oh, you're awesome.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
This is, okay, thank you.
Dave Emery.